Hi there, I'm Wolf Harant, Oscar Echo One Whiskey Hotel Charlie, the curator of the QSL Collection, the International Research and Documentation Center for the History of Radio Communications. And I talked to Danny Weil, or Danny Weil, as he called himself, on occasion of his 80th birthday.
I was born in the East End of London, down by the docks there, where everybody worked for a... As children, we worked for the Jewish people for about a penny a week, certain times of the year that the Jewish people are not allowed to do any work, so they hire people from outside, and we'd work for a whole week on that for about a penny. But that was, you could get something for a penny in those days. But then from elementary school to going through the usual schooling period, then to central school, then to secondary school, and finally prep school, and then college. Well, I always wanted to be an engineer. Because as a child, where I lived, there was the man next door to where I lived. He was quite an ardent motorcyclist. And as a child, I used to work with him. I built my first motorcycle when I was 11 years old.
Well, you talk of engineering. I mean, you mean motorcycles and not radios.
Yeah, well, anything to do with mechanical, the mechanical field. I've always been involved with the mechanical stuff, even in the Royal Air Force. That was London Technical College.
And you graduated from that?
Yeah. I got my degree when I was 16 years old.
You must have been a brilliant student.
Well, I was. I went through the stages of education all the way up, you see. In England in those days, you could go through various standards, but if you were better, you moved up to... If you have to be a little bit more educated than others, they moved you up a couple of grades. Well, when I got out of that, they got me a job at the Havilland's Aircraft. And I went there with an engineering degree, and the first thing they did, they put me on a bench there with a foreman, and my job was to take in the burrs off of pieces of metal being through a pressing machine. I lasted with them about 2 weeks, and I told the foreman what he could do with his job. I then, unbeknown to my family, I got a job as a truck driver. I had to be on the road. I wanted to be moving. So I got a job as a truck driver until my family found out. Then I got the usual belting. And then the next move after that, they conned me into joining the Air Force. And a guy down the street was an ex-Royal Air Force. Well, he was in the Royal Air Force. And he came up and gave me such a brilliant story about the Royal Air Force that I went and joined it. And, of course, going in with a degree, it helped me a lot because after I did the usual business, of the usual stuff that one does do to join a service, you know, what we call square bashing, going around with a rifle and doing the parade ground stuff. With a degree, they put me as an instructor. I believe it was in South Wales. That's where I was teaching people the use of machine shop tools and everything else, which was more in my field, until I got moved out of there into a squadron. I went in for that and got on airframes. Most of my work was done on airframes. I was out in the Middle East for a while, and then the last location we had with a squadron was up in Norway, near Narvik. When we got back, I got back to England after the war, and they put me down in south part of England, near Southampton. Then I was in charge of maintenance down there for a while, of aircraft. The Americans had left the airstrip to pick up all the bits and pieces, and I stayed there for a while. And that's how I learned how to drive these big trucks with an airplane on it and learn how to knock lampposts down. So one of my jobs actually was involved strictly with mechanical stuff of taking all the bits and pieces off airplanes and going out to the crash sites and bringing them in. So that was more or less my service life. Then I came back to England and I went into my family's business, my father's business, who was a watchmaker, and opened up a bombed-out store in London. So I'd already knew the watchmaking business. I was also a sign writer, too. I used to make odd money while I was in the service of doing all these big signs out of movie houses, you know, these big signs, forthcoming attractions and all that stuff. I really wanted to get into a machine shop when I came out of, you know, came out of the service. But I didn't have any money anyway. Nobody ever has any money after leaving the Royal Air Force. So I did the next best thing. I did have my father's tools, which was fortunate, opened up in the watch business. And I'm not going to go through all the paraphernalia of that, but I went into repairing watches, clocks, doing jewelry work, and also got into the point of buying stuff from Switzerland, movements, and putting those into watches, blah, 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 blah. You know, going into all the little things of running a business. And then finally, I moved to the southern part of England where I had been stationed and joined a yacht club down there and learned how to sail a 12-foot dinghy.
Did it come all of a sudden that you wanted to go yachting and sailing?
Well, no. When I moved down to near Southampton, a place called Bournemouth, and I went down to the yacht club to see what they were doing, just for the heck of it. I'd never sailed in my life before. And finally, I bought myself a little tiny 12-foot dinghy and learned how to capsize that thing in six different ways. I bought a 16-footer. That was the next one. And what I didn't know about it was rotten. And when I took it out into the English Channel, it wasn't very far out before it sunk. And, of course, I managed to get ashore. I lost the boat. And from that point onwards, I got tied in with the yacht clubs, you know, all the rest of it. And I sailed with one or two others there on just on small dinghies, you know, 12, 14-footers. And then I found a place near Southampton where there was a boat underwater. Been there for the last 200 years, I would think. I think the Normans must have used it. I couldn't afford a big boat. So what I did is I talked to some people in Christchurch, which is near Southampton and Bournemouth, that area. And one of the fellows that I'd been in the Air Force with, his father owned a boatyard. They said that well, they could lift this thing out of the water, which we went over there and I dived down and put oil drums and everything else around it. And we lifted it and we towed it back to the boatyard and pulled it out on the land. And, of course, in the process of pulling it out, it gradually all fell to pieces. It was all rotten. But using it as a design, I rebuilt the whole thing. And I spent about 4 years doing that. Finally finished up with a boat, and then I thought, here's a darn good excuse now to get the hell out of England. I couldn't stand the weather there. And then I took off.
Was this already Yasmin 1?
That was Yasmin 1, yeah.
How did you come to christen that boat Yasmin?
Well, I was talking to a friend of mine, ex-Air Force buddy, and he'd been a Japanese prisoner of war. It's derived from the word of freedom, which he told me. I had no way of confirming it. Means freedom. And I thought, well, this was one of my excuses for getting the hell out of England. Freedom. Mm-hmm. I wanted the freedom to get out.
In 1954, you set sails for the first time.
Yes, and of course, we had all the newspapers there, and the mayor of Bournemouth, or the mayor of Poole, came down, when my mother came down, and there was a big crowd to see me off. And that was it. From England, I got down to... I managed to get through the Bay of Biscay because I learned navigation on the way. I wasn't too sure of my navigation, but I learned how to use the sextant by doing it the hard way. And I had Nichols' Concise Guide of Navigations, which is logs and anti-logs and a heck of a lot of mathematics. Mathematics didn't bother me too much, but figuring all that stuff out and converting from sights of the sun in the raging sea and me being seasick, I can tell you this, any time I got a position at sea, I was never too sure about it. But I always kept awake all at night so I could see if there was any land around, you know. That's how sure I was. But anyway, cut a long story short, I did meet a fellow in Christchurch where I built the boat. He was a radio man, and he got me all rigged up with a phone system. And I worked in there with him to build the darn thing, build a small unit there to give me 115 volts and all that sort of thing. And there was a way on it that I could talk to him on CW. My CW was very slow, but at least I could tell him that I hadn't died, you know. But that was my first initiation into getting into radio, but very, very primitive. It was just a means to say I was still alive, and that's about it. But there was no ham radio tied into it. That's how I got G7DW. That was a fake call. It's never been there. There was never original.
Mm-hmm.
But it gave me something to call on the air with. And, of course, everybody answered to it, and they didn't give a damn either. All the rest of my calls after that were all legitimate ones.
Yeah, but you never did have a QSL for G7DW, did you?
No.
Yeah,
I don't remember. Okay, from there, I first of all got involved down in Gibraltar with Jacques Cousteau, and that's the first time I'd heard anything about the aqualung, and I didn't know anything about diving, but Cousteau was very helpful. I had to take the propeller off my boat, which was damaged, and down at Gibraltar, they gave me the facilities of the Air Force base down there to fix the propeller, and Cousteau got the old one off and put the new one on. And in return, what he gave me was the aqualung, a complete aqualung system. And I, in return, repaired his chronometer for him, because that was my field. Cousteau and I and his boat we passed each other several times, and the last time I think that we were actually together was in the Galapagos, and he taught me a lot about diving. Anyway, cut a long story short without exaggeration, I met up with him, then I met some of his crew and his captain. I met him in Tahiti. Then I talked to him several times on my way from Tahiti when I was going down to New Caledonia and all that area, Wallace Island. I was in communication with him by radio. So, of course, incidentally, on my trip across the reason I got tied in with ham radio, you may know about this, that crossing the Atlantic, I got into St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands where I met KV4AA. And it was through him, through Dick Spensley, that he got me really involved with ham radio, and I went through the formalities of a test. He taught me CW. I was pretty slow, but I got there. And also the general idea of radio, what the hell that goes on inside, all that stuff. Well, he got me involved with ham radio. I'd sit in his shack there, and of course he had all sorts of gear. He talked to me an awful long time, and I was in the harbor down there with my boat. And, of course, meeting with him and his wife and family. And, of course, he had a little business there. His wife ran a business there. And they were selling watches. And also, I got involved down there while I was in St. Thomas of working on ships' marine chronometers because I was a certified marine chronometer and adjuster. That's another little thing that I got involved with. So I was making a few bucks down there. And, of course, I met a few girls down there. I didn't get involved with them. Dick seemed to feel that somewhere along the line that I could do all these things, even though my knowledge of ham radio was a big zero. I mean, the knowledge I had was just picked up in the time I was down there. And after I got my ticket from Tortola, which was VP2VB, yeah. Yeah, VP2VA was the commissioner of Tortola. It gave me VP2VB, which was the next call in that listing. From then onwards, with that call, I went on the air after I left St. Thomas. Of course, Dick got in contact with Hallicrafters, Collins, and a lot of other people, and we all got little bits and pieces of gear, a lot of it quite primitive stuff. It was an old Hammond, and, oh, my golly, it's no good me trying to remember.
Now you started all your great journeys, and how did you plan them? Did you really plan a route, or did it just carry on? Did you have a certain...
Well, no, Dick knew where I was. When I left St. Thomas, he started telling me, he'd already informed me about all the different places I could go to, you know. So, of course, part of my job was to go to the Canal Zone, where I got my KZ-5 call, and I got a test down there, and got my KZ-5WD call from the Canal Zone. And then from then onwards, Dick would tell me all the different places where it would be good to go to, which were rare countries. So, of course, from there, I went across to the Galapagos and several of the other places, which are all listed. I don't remember them all now.
Had you been aware at that time, too, that you were the number one there?
No, I hadn't the faintest idea. No, it was just part of the job. There were places to go to, and I knew I could get there. Of course, my navigation was getting a little bit better then. I was able to go to A, B, and C and get there.
Did you always pass a test, or how was it at that time to get a license, or did it just choose your call sign?
Well, no, some countries gave me a license based on what Dick told them and also my background. And, of course, bear in mind that all applications for a license go through the communications officer. And the communications officer of each country was very much aware of my background. So there were some places there was never any problems regarding getting a license.
Did you have problems sometimes somewhere with a license?
No, never, never. No, all the call signs that I have are all legitimate, and I've got all the paperwork. I've still got most of it here in all the licenses I've had.
You must have drawn a big pileup whenever you operated one of those islands and countries.
Well, places like Baja Nueva was one place. Avis Island was another one where you got a stack of calls. You see, there's nobody on the island. It's a remote island, miles from any place. Only an idiot or a lunatic would ever try to go there. I was a lunatic in those days, you see.
Today we put down big generators. How did you operate the station from an island?
Well, I had an Onan generator, gasoline-driven generator, which I carried ashore. Today I don't think I could even pick one up at my age. But in those days, I could pick the darn things up and also my kilowatt rig. And, you know, the Helicraft kilowatt amplifier was all that I could do was to pick it up. Today it takes about four guys to pick one up. The HD32, HD33, and the 101. I had a Collins 75A4. In fact, I have still got the 75A4 here in my shop here.
What type of antennas did you use?
Antenna, a piece of wire. In the trees, what I had is a bow and arrow. And I shoot up into the trees, and it was a sort of, you might call it an inverted V, shall we say? The other place is I did have a form of a tower, which I carried on the side of the boat, which was a mixture of galvanized iron, pieces of wire and string. And that's about, and just horse it up the best you could. On the boat itself, I had a driven beam, a three-element beam, on the main part of the boat. And, of course, I had a vertical right on the bow and another vertical on the rear on a strut. I can tell you this, when I fired up a kilowatt on the boat and I went out and got a bit of RF through him, he nearly threw me over the side.
He must have been a real star at that time.
Well, a lot of people don't realize this, but because it was never publicized. But Dick was instrumental in shipping me some ham radio gear or radio communications gear, which I dropped off at some of these islands and set them up because they did have power in them. So they was able to utilize them, and I showed them. I couldn't teach them CW, but I could teach them phone, and they had an AM rig running about a 100-watt rig. And Dick was instrumental in getting a lot of the stuff shipped over to me. This was never publicized, which I'm sorry it wasn't, because he was very, very helpful in those days of doing this. Where he got the equipment from other hams, I don't know. But it gave me the opportunity that when I reached these islands, I was to set up a small transmitter, which was a receiver and a transmitter. They weren't transceivers in those days. And also enough wire. I just rigged up just a long wire antenna cut to length, mostly on 20 meters. So that was how it was all done. These are a lot of things. Also, when I got married to Naomi, she was a nurse, and she helped in many, many of these islands, particularly, let's see, I think, both in Tahiti and also in the Galapagos, where she was in the doctor's place there and working with them there, because she had a terrific background. She'd in the service. She was a nurse in the service. These are a lot of the stuff that was never publicized, if you get my meaning.
Could you just go back for a sec how you met Naomi? This was a decisive point in your life.
Oh, I met Naomi. I was Dick set up a lecture tour for me. The lecture tour was partly to raise funds to get another boat. That was the Yasmi 3. He arranged it through radio clubs throughout the United States. And it was a lecture tour, and I covered every state in the Union. And the whole trip, I think, took about a year to 15 months. I can't remember exactly. But, of course, I've got all sorts of awards from all of the clubs. So I got publicized in newspapers, magazines, and everything else. And then also in the process of the lecture tour, I landed up in Tampa, Florida. And there I met Colonel Tibbetts. He's the guy that dropped the atom bomb. Fortunately, he was a ham radio operator, too. So we had quite a bit in common. Also, I was introduced to Naomi down there, just as a sort of someone to talk with. She was a confidential secretary to a big organization, had a very good job, and a very well-paying job, too, which incidentally she gave all up to come out with a nut like me. We went together, and I was doing some work also for the University of Miami Marine Lab, dropping five hydrophones over the rear of the boat. A lot of this stuff was never publicized. And also, I was doing the work for Rodman Naval Station down in the canal zone between them and MacDill Air Force Base. I had a lot of government gear put on my boat, which they installed using ham radio and communications and all the rest of it. And also, I had it loaded onto the boat in Tampa, Florida. And then from there down to, it was all unloaded down at Rodman Naval Station. Rodman was another point of view in part of our life. Was after I met Naomi, we got together quite a bit, and finally I proposed to her by ham radio on my trip from Tampa down to the canal zone. I proposed to her by ham radio, and she accepted, and she flew down there. We got married in the canal zone. Oh, yeah, and she could steer the boat, and yeah. I taught her means of helping me with the navigation, because she was pretty good at mathematics, too. Better than me sometimes. But we operated down there. Of course, I operated from Ecuador. Ecuador is, you know, where the wedding was. They had a big wedding group down there going. Yeah. And Naomi and I were married in 1960. And she got quite sick out in Samoa. And we decided to send her back to the States, which she did. She spent some time with some friends of mine in Hawaii, and then California, then back to Tampa. I went on from there to wherever I went to, Fiji or some places like that. And then I got tired of going any further that way, so I turned around and did another stupid thing. I sailed across the Pacific, going from the west to the east. Nobody in their right mind does that, because you're fighting the trade winds all the way. Well, I was all single-handed before I met Naomi. But after being with her, I wanted to get back to her. So I managed to get back to the States with the boat in one piece and all the rest of it. And finally, Hal gave me my first job in the United States in a company he had. It was a geophysical company. And worked on a lot of work there, designed a plant for him, did all the electrical layouts and all the rest of it, trained a maintenance crew. And I spent a couple of years with him. And then he bought the boat, mainly to have it. You know, he wanted to have it, so he bought the boat. And that was the story there. Oh, I know what happened. After I left Hal, somebody learned that I was a specialist in high-pressure hydraulic systems, because I used to work on that in the Royal Air Force. And I got involved with the design of the atomic domes, you know, that we have in the United States, on all the hydraulic system to erect them. And I got involved with all that. I did a lot of design work for them.
Why did you quit amateur radio at that time? I mean, you never got the...
Well, when I got back to the States off the record, I had lots of promises from guys. Because I let my license lapse, which I shouldn't have done, but I did. And I had lots of promises about guys who were going to help me get my license, but all these promises went out the window, and that was about it. I didn't have a United States call. The only American call I had was the KZ-5. I thought with all the licenses that I'd had that I would have probably got a license without going through a lot of all the garbage of going through a test, but that's not the point. I wasn't thinking so much of that. But I'm too darned old to remember all these new frequencies and all that stuff.
You've been so active in amateur radio, and all of a sudden you decided, okay, let it be.
See, I didn't have all that much money. When I didn't make any money out of the ham radio expeditions. I got a lot of reputation, you know, on paper. But it didn't produce any money. The only money I ever got producing was when I got back to the States and I got a job. I had to start from the bottom and go and get a job and do work that I was accustomed to doing, you know, which was I was trained to do. So ham radio had to take a second seat. I couldn't afford to go and buy all that equipment and everything else. And I was also married. And bear in mind, my wife had given up her job, so I had had her to be with me. And I got several different positions all over the United States, in California, Flint, Michigan. You mention it. I've been there. To go into different companies advising them how to set up their plants, how to design the special equipment to manufacture different things. And I've got a couple of patents in my name as well on stuff that I've designed. So I had quite a reputation as an engineer.
What about sailing? Did you quit sailing as well?
Oh, yes, I quit that altogether when the boat was gone. Then after I finished... Naomi got tired of chasing around the country with me, you know, in my work. So finally we settled down in San Antonio, and then I went down and to teach a guy that was brand new in the game, and he wanted to open up as a watch and clockmaker. So he asked me, he knew about me, and I went down and I trained him and got him to run his business and has set up his business. And I decided, why the heck should I go and work for him for free when I could open up my own business? So I opened up a watch and clock business, which I spent several years under the name of London Watch and Clock Corporation. And I did pretty well on that. And, of course, then when Naomi worked with me in the watch and clock business, and then we decided it was time to quit that lark. So we both liked to travel, so I bought an RV. And between us, we traveled all over the United States. We didn't have any ham radio. We didn't even have a telephone. We didn't tell anybody where we were going. We just went. And we lived a very, very happy life. And since then, which is now, it will be 3 years in May of this coming year, that she's been gone.
Must have been very, very difficult for you.
It is. I've never met anybody since. All of the stuff I had have gone. Mm-hmm. And we moved so much since I got back to the United States. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had boxes and boxes of papers and stuff. We moved from place to place. I think I may have a couple of books of the old logs, and that's about it. Maybe you can find somebody over here that can get me a license without me going through all the stupidity. I'd like to get back on the air again.
Danny, let's close down. Thank you very, very much indeed for talking to me this morning.
Bye-bye.